Hi, this is Megan McHugh, and this is the podcast of Triple R Zero G, a weekly radio show exploring science fiction, fantasy, and historical. Zero G is broadcast live on Triple R from Melbourne, Australia, every Monday. Hope you enjoy the podcast, and feel free to get in touch with us via our Facebook page or the Triple R website.
G'day, welcome aboard the Starship Zero-G Science Fiction, Fantasy and Historical Radio for episode number 1582, entitled The Churn. Our podcast title is Two-Pod. And g'day, thanks to everybody out there for turning up on Easter. I'm Rob Chan, and our co-host Megan McHugh is away leading a team through the Stargate today. We would like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land of the Wurundjeri on which we gather today and broadcast from and to. We would also like to pay our respects to the elders past, present and future, which actually kind of describes the fact that I'm going to congratulations to Marvel's The Avengers, who's frequently rebooted my entire comic book, has recently notionally clocked up 800-odd issues collectively since they were introduced way back in 1963. Yeah, I know, the British TV show The Avengers was first broadcast in 1961. Yes, you know, don't send me emails about that. How many Avengers have there been in the roster? More than 100, less than 1,000 in the comics? You might argue for there being more for the movies, since Captain America rallied the Avengers at the Battle of Avengers Compound in the Avengers Endgame movie, and thousands of allies responded to that. Are they all Avengers? I don't know. Ask Cap. Come a long way in the comics since the initial founding members teamed up to fight Loki, just like in the movie, really. Iron Man, Thor, Hulk, Ant-Man and the Wasp were the founding members, soon after they added Captain America and dropped Hulk out of it, after Cap thawed out from his decades-long ice nap, being a capsicle. So I thought I'd just have a bit of a celebration here by playing one of my favourite renditions of Silvestri's Avengers theme, and that would be an a cappella version from Warp Zone. The Warp Zone are a Los Angeles-based comedy parody a cappella group who appeared on Fantasy Got Talent Season 2, and they also have a YouTube channel, so you can check them out there. Been an occasional guest on Smosh Games, if you know that site. Its members are Michael Davis, Ryan Tellers, David Odom, Brian Fisher and Michael Schroeder, and they do a lot of a cappella covers of genre themes and music, so good for them. They are not Maytree from South Korea, but they're not too bad themselves. So here we go with the Avengers theme, a cappella from the Warp Zone.
Zero G, and I feel fine. Capsule is turning around. Oh, that view is tremendous.
Yeah, and we had there the Avengers theme done a cappella by the Warp Zone, just to celebrate the fact that the Avengers roster is ginormous now, and I don't mean just Giant Man or Goliath or whatever, or even the Wasp when she's in that larger mode. What do they call it? It's Stature, I think. Or is that the younger Wasp? Oh, who knows? There's too many to keep track of. And yeah, 800 issues of the Avengers comic book. Thereabouts, because, I mean, you know, there have been multiple spin-offs, West Coast Avengers and Young Avengers, you know, just Mighty Avengers. It goes on forever, actually, and so it should, too. We can all use some heroes as well as all the other things at the moment. That's why I called, actually, the show The Churn today. I'm just thinking of what they call the great tempestuous times in the science fiction series The Expanse. We're all just hanging on by our fingernails and hoping we can survive it all one way or another. Well, speaking of people who are out in space and, you know, don't actually have to hang on to anything out there in zero gravity, Artemis 2 continues on its 10-day mission flyby around the moon and back. Some Randolorian thoughts, and some of them even might be my own. Four astronauts. one woman and three men, and the commander's name is Reed. Now, I'm not saying that they are the Fantastic Four, but crikey. The astronaut's name is actually spelt R-E-I-D and not R-E-E-D, and his last name is Wiseman, not Richards, so he's not Reed Richards. So Wiseman does actually suggest Reed Richards' signature big brain nickname. I have seen quite a few memes out there saying, why don't we all dress up in Planet of the Apes costumes so when they land back on Earth and they open the capsule that they think that they've gone through a time walk and they've landed on the Planet of the Apes. I think a much better thing to do would be when the astronauts go around the dark side of the moon and they come back into visual range on the in terms of the transmission from the feed from the capsule. It would be fun if they'd cobbled together Fantastic Four costumes because, you know, they've had their cosmic origin out there. I'm sure they can do that. They're astronauts. They're clever people. Build the costumes out of procedure covers and duct tape and other common items found aboard the ship. Oh, no, they're not going to land on the moon and return with a moon rocky. As amaze that would be. It's a lunar flyby mission designed to crew test the hardware for future lunar missions. I have an app on my phone, a NASA app, and it actually, you know, is tracking the thing. It's a day 4 and 4 hours, travelling at 1,394 miles per hour, so really stepping out there. 230,000 miles from Earth, and the distance to the moon is only 43,000 miles, so they're quite into that at this stage. What a great thing, I can actually track the mission on my app. I can remember back in the day being glued to the radio or to the television coverage that they used to have with some of the early missions of the space shuttle or, you know, Skylab and so on. Well, actually, I do remember when they landed on the moon in 1969 too, watching it at school on a black and white television set. But now I have an app on my phone. They are expected, that is to say the astronauts, to pass the furthest distance that humans have flown from Earth. Very soon, a record set by Apollo 13 in the 1970. Yes, that means we will be the humans furthest away from Donald Trump, the lucky bastards. And speaking of the spacecraft, the individual crew capsule is named Integrity. It is an Orion space capsule. The whole rocket is the SLS, the Space Launch System, most of that being discarded by now, of course. And the mission is designated Artemis II. Artemis I was the previous successful unmanned lunar flyby mission. And there's a lot of heritage and legacy hardware involved in all of this, recycled or flight-tested. It's all in how you look at it. The liquid fuel engines, shuttle engines, space shuttle engines, the solid rocket boosters were made from recovered solid rocket booster segments flown during the shuttle program. They used to recover the SRBs when they splashed down in the ocean on parachutes, and they'd bring them back and they'd clean them out because they had solid rocket booster propellant residue still inside them. Then they'd check them out and reassemble them and put new propellant filament in them, and then Bob's your uncle, they'd fly off again. So, you know, most of all of that stuff is now at the bottom of the ocean, or will be, as the Artemis program hardware is not intended to be recovered and reused. Although the capsule itself is recovered, I don't know if it's reusable or not. I don't think so. I'm willing to be corrected on that. Artemis 2 is the first crewed lunar flyby in just over half a century. I paused to ponder that. The last one, which took place in December 1972, astronauts Eugene Cernan and Harrison Schmitt were the last humans to walk on the moon during that mission. And here they are now. At the same time, because I can hold at least two ideas in my head simultaneously, I'm certified for that. In addition to the awesome wonder of spaceflight and a keen awareness of the challenges of this magnificent endeavour, there lies and not for the first time in history, to be sure, the awareness of the dichotomy of the United States of America and its actions off and on Earth at the present. It does remind me that the 1969 moon landing took place during the Second Southeast Asian War in and around Vietnam. The hardware has advanced, but humanity has perhaps not noticeably done so. Astronautical terms, retrograde motion in certain respects. At any rate, I'm always appreciative when the rockets are aimed on Earth orbit escape trajectories and not ballistic ones designed to hit people on the ground. We aim at the stars, but sometimes we hit Iran. Or you can insert your country of practically whatever era you can think of. And yes, that's partly a Tom Lehrer quote. My Facebook friends and Zero G audience are educated. All right, let's have a track here now to celebrate the Artemis II mission. And actually, Zero G's muse, almost space muse, Basement Spaceman, actually has an album out at the moment. Apollo 17 is called, 3 Days on the Moon. And there's a track here which is called Ride to the Moon. So the perfect soundtrack to celebrate the Artemis II lunar flyby mission.
Hi, I'm Steve Squires. I worked on the Mars exploration rovers, Voyager, Magellan, and Cassini space missions, and I wrote the book Roving Mars. So if anyone should understand Zero-G, think it would be me. Nah, sorry. Zero-G, science fiction and fantasy radio on 3RRR FM.
There we had a track from the One Piece television series. Well, actually, that was a bit of a knockoff from Geek Music. And, yeah, it's basically the part of the theme for One Piece, the live-action television show. The very, very, very strongest, and by originally Sonia Belousova and Giona Ostinelli, composers for the live-action One Piece television series. And I just played that because I want to talk about that today. Their second season has dropped on telly, and you can watch it on Netflix. And we have reviewed the first season of it previously. Pause here to note that I've got a note on the Zero G Facebook page, Mark, saying that he's appreciating, because it's Easter, listening to Zero G Live. Yeah, well, it's about as live as we actually get. I mean, I've had my shots. You know, I hasten to add, I've actually never been bit. Just rolling my sleeve over the marks there. It's a bit of a giveaway. But yeah, it's fun to be here on Easter during public holiday. People listening in who don't actually get a chance to listen in live. Yeah, you know, unless you give up your lunch hour. And why wouldn't you? I don't know. Zero G turns my stomach, so there we go. Anyway, nice to hear from people. Don't forget, we do have a Facebook page, Zero G, and of course, also we do podcasts still, and also audio on demand at the splendid RRR site, rrr.org.au. And I do remind you at the moment that we are in April amnesty space here at RRR, so, you know, if you care to put a few coins towards RRR, that'd be much appreciated. Subscribe, all those good things, as usual. We'll get back to that a little bit later. But speaking of coins, actually, I don't know if the One Piece is a coin. I guess it could be. But the One Piece is a television show. Originally a Japanese manga series illustrated by Eiichiro Oda, serialized, oh gosh, since 1997, since which it has bordered and captured all media. The Toei Animation TV series is seen on television around the world. That's the animated one. Streams on Netflix and has other venues and has clocked up about 1,100 episodes since 1999. There are movies as well, animated movies, And now we have the 2023 Netflix live action series. Was it really the first season that came out in all those years ago? I thought it was more recent than that. And now they are back for more. Developed by Matt Owens and Steve Maeda. The third season is actually in production now, even as the second season has dropped in all its glory. The further adventures of the not a crew of the pirate ship Going Merry, captained by the highly energetic and motivated Monkey D. Luffy, accompanied by navigator Nami, master swordsman Zoro, and ship's cook Sanji, and their marksman as well. The other character, whose name escapes me for the moment. They are now sailing the Grand Line Ocean. Now, this is set really kind of on a parallel sort of different world, but it's partly like Earth and partly not. And it's divided into different oceans by mountain ranges. Lots and lots of islands around there. And now they're in the Grand Line Ocean, searching small and large island chains strewn across this basically water world. Captain Luffy wants to find the legendary One Piece treasure of the title, possession of which will mean he becomes the next king of the pirates. What an an aspiration. Now, this world is split up into different factions. There are rival pirates also vying for the One Piece. The world government and its anti-pirate marines, including Luffy's own grandfather, who is a rear admiral. There are revolutionaries fighting against the world government. That's something we haven't seen too much of now, apart from the sort of pirate aspect, because they're against the world gov as well, mostly. But that's sort of coming into play at the end of this season. And the Baroque Works, who are an organisation of assassins with their own agendas, who the Going Merry crew have attracted the ire of. Now, the thing is that in this strange world, the technological level is, well, it's sort of set at sailing ships, but they also have gunpowder, advanced metallurgy, and also these odd telepathic snails, large snails, like sit on your desk kind of thing, about the size of a computer monitor, and they are in telepathic contact with each other, so they function as sort of large desktop communication devices. So it's a very strange sort of mix of technology all thrown in there. And the other thing about it is that there are these things called devil fruits. If you eat these devil fruits, you will acquire a superpower of one sort or another. So in a way, it is a bit of a superhero show or a supervillain show, depending upon whose side you are on at the time. For example, Luffy has the power of stretching, kind of like Mr. Fantastic from the Fantastic Four, or Kamala Khan in her comic book incarnation, at least. So, yeah, rubber limbs, basically. He is as wild a mix of enthusiasm and laid-back, loose cannon-ness-y as ever in this one. Anyway, I'd like to actually play another track right now. I think we'll go with Wealth, Fame, Power by Sonia Velasova and Gianna Ostinelli from the One Piece television series.
Hi, this is Scott Bakula. Welcome aboard Zero G.
Yeah, we had Sonia Belisova and Gianna Ostinelli's piece there from the One Piece television show, the live-action one, that is. Sonia has actually quite a bit of form, a Russian-American composer, music producer, songwriter, artist as well, who's probably most known for Toss a Coin to Your Witcher. Work a lot of television shows of great fame and renown, like The Witcher. And also did that most recent Red Sonja movie, which I have not actually caught up with yet. Not heard a lot of great things about it, but I remember the music on The Mist, the television series, too. Well, it's turning out a few ballets. Scoring partner is Gianna Ostinelli, so a bit of a team there, compositional team. Not a crew. We are talking about One Piece, Season 2 on Netflix, which has dropped all of its episodes. season two is an awesome season. I thought it was pretty good in the first season, but they have really picked it up in this one. I know they've got a lot of ocean to cover because, you know, 1,000-odd episodes of the animated series can't easily be encompassed in a single season, but they're kind of cleaving mostly to the early episodes there. And, you know, this is like years ago now, but it still reads to me, because I haven't, to be honest, haven't watched anywhere near a large number of episodes of the animated series. But I do regret that now. I feel like I would have really enjoyed it. I have actually caught up with a few of them since and have enjoyed them as well. Ah, but to have grown up with them, that would have been much more fun. Anyway, Iñaki Godoy is still amazing as Monkey D. Luffy. It's like he's just come right out of the animated screen to play this one with his flexible limbs and his over-enthusiasm. It's just a wonderful performance here, and definitive too. I don't think there could be a better Luffy than this guy. Emily Rudd still plays Nami, back for that. We have seen her in the horror series on Netflix, Fear Street. She is still trying to chart the entire world. And they do have these sort of tropic ideas of where the characters are going. Luffy has his obsession with becoming the Pirate King, but also having a good time along the way and being totally loyal to his not-a-crew. Naomi is very much struck with navigational matters, but she's also kind of unimpressed sometimes with her many male shipmates aboard the Going Merry pirate ship. At the same time, in this season, she does spend a bit of time laid up by being virtue of being ill for various reasons. And that's an important plot point in season two. Makenyu is playing Roronoa Zora, the free sword style swordsman. He is still brooding, and he's got more to brood about this season, for he had an embarrassing defeat at the hands of another master swordsman. So partly this season is about him trying to perfect his own sword styles and get better at it, and also get some new swords as well, which he does find along the way. A fine performance. Again, all of these people, they look like they stepped out of the anime. The casting in this show is absolutely spot on. We've got Sanji, the master chef, and what would you call him? He's a kicker, basically. He fights with his feet a lot when he's not tossing chef knives around. Taz Skylar plays that role. And he's got a good thing going with Zoro. They've got a rivalry as well. And he's a bit more sweet on Nami than he was in the first season, as he gets to know it too. So there's a potential romantic interest there. We've also got Jacob Romero Gibson playing one of the new crew, Usopp, who's the marksman. He's very good at firing from a shanghai, a slingshot, these little potent sort of projectiles which can do all sorts of things. I suppose he's the Hawkeye of the crew, really. He's a bit, I won't call him a coward, because they fight in all sorts of weird and wonderful situations, and anyone would be well advised to be a little bit trepidatious about all this sort of stuff. But yeah, he has his own character arc in this season as well that I thought was really quite well realised. We have part of the Baroque assassin group, Sharithara Chandran, playing Nefertiti Vivi, or Miss Wednesday. Now, she is a British actress. We've seen her in Bridgerton, where she plays Edwina Sharma in season two. In this, in One Piece, she plays a princess of the Desert Kingdom, Alabasta, who is now working in the Baroque Works Assassin Guild. And she encounters Luffy and his Straw Hat Pirates along the way. We've also got, and this is an important one too, Lyra Abova, a Russian actress who is playing Nico Robin and slash Miss All Sunday. Now, that will be mean a lot to people who've watched the animated series, less so to people who've just tuned in for this one. But, yeah, she's a model and actress and was in a variety of things. Her devil fruit that she ate allows her to duplicate her limbs in the bodies of other people, which means that, like, you know, her target could suddenly grow two extra arms, which they'd start punching the poor unfortunate victim in the face. Now, she's going to go for a big evolution in this season and into the next, so look out for Nico's character, Miss All Sunday. And the female members of the Baroque Works crew all have weekday sort of names after them. The other ones are just called numbers, so they get a bit of a better shake there than the other ones. Another character pops up in this is Smoker, played by Kellum Kerr, Scottish actor, who we have seen in the Wheel of Time Amazon Prime series. And he smoked a devil fruit, sorry, he ate a devil fruit, which allows his body to transform into smoke. Consequently, he seems to smoke all the time. He uses large cigars as well. He's actually a quite an engaging character. He's gruff and entirely ruthlessly devoted to hunting down pirates. So he's actually one of the Marines, really. He rides around on this great freewheeler contraption. Just a strange sort of character, really. In this one, we also see some other Baroque Works assassins, pirates slash assassins. There's Mr. Five, played by Cameron Johnson. His devil fruit power is he can detonate his mucus. A little bit like Gambit in the X-Men, but there you go. That's a vile, vile power. He is an absolute booger of a character. And we have David Dast-Malchian playing number three. This is one of the Baroque Works assassins who can produce wax from his hands, which you would think would be not the best character, but this is it works out in the end. He waxes lyrical enough to provide entertainment during the story. We've seen this character pop up in superhero movies, actually, in the MCU and also the DCU, so like the Dark Knight, Suicide Squad. I've been in some animated films as well. So he's an actor who I've seen before, but perhaps not quite so dripping candle wax as in this one. He was also in Denis Villeneuve films Prisoners, Blade Runner 2049 and Dune. So, yeah, he's actually been around a lot. But you may remember when we talked about him appearing in Late Night with the Devil. He's that guy. Who else would you know? Where else would you know him from? Murderbot, I guess, yeah. They've got a lot of people in this one who've new guest stars. Katie Sagal plays a doctor on Drum Island. We know her, of course, as Peg Bundy on Married with Children, but also mostly for Zero G, Taranga Leela, the Cyclops on Futurama. We also have Mark Herlich playing Dr. Hiralok, who's a doctor on Drum Island. He's been around for a long time. Seen him in Jurassic Park 3, Will and Grace, Big Bang Theory, Bones, Breaking Bad. He was in the Angel series playing a character called Count Kurushu, as well as being in episodes of Star Trek Voyager. Once played God in the TV series Preacher. So, yeah, this is a season which tears your heart out with all these great guest actors appearing and the regulars firing on all four cylinders. It's a tear-your-heart-out season. There's an episode where there's a whale who... as in a sea whale, who waited for its pet pirates to return. It's so sad. And then there's Chopper, the deer medic. You see what I did there, who's a sweet little CGI character, and his tragic backstory. Oh. And then there's the two Viking-like giants engaged in a centuries-long duel that we run into. And there's a dinosaur island where Luffy decides to ride a herbivorous dinosaur because, of course, he does. And speaking of courses, a carnivorous dinosaur has to be battled, killed and cooked because, of course, the crew has to do that. Then there's Zora and his Kill Bill-style epic sword fight around the village. Oh, magnificent stuff in this season, really finding its feet as an ongoing live-action show. I think they're really doing the animated show proud, and I just cannot wait for the third season. And I know it takes a while to do because the production values on this are awesome. The sets, the costumes, the special effects. A lot of it seems to be done in camera too. And, you know, it is just an amazing series. One Piece, Season 2 now, doing animation adaptations proud. We've had a lot of good game adaptations recently, and the animation ones are not lagging at all. What song will we go out from that little enthusiastic bit of piracy there? My Sails Are Set from the Netflix series One Piece, featuring Aurora, again composed by Sonia Belisova and Gianna Ostinelli.
Broadcast mode. This is Crichton, the service android aboard the Starship Zero-G on 3RRR FM. SOS! SOS! Mayday! Help! I am being held captive by rogue makeup artists who want to cover my face in plaster and latex rubber. Panic mode. Get me the hell out of here!
Thank you, Dylan. That was a well-played summation there for the April amnesty. It's on now, RRR FM. Rob Jan here with Zero G. We've just been talking, well, I've just been burbling about the One Piece season. There's so much good stuff on at the moment. You know, if this is going to be the accompaniment to any kind of apocalypse, I did call today's episode The Churn for good reasons, or bad reasons, I suppose. You know, we could do worse. That is of absolutely no comfort at all. But sail on to a movie which is on Amazon Prime called Pretty Lethal. I just happened to stumble into this. It's a fun, weird, gory little B-grade actioner. 2026 film directed by Vicky Jusen and written by Kate Freund. Right now, Vicky is known for a film called Lady Godiva in 2008. She's a British director. Born of War in 2014, Close in 2019. And Close was the one which starred Noomi Rapace, where Rapace was playing a female bodyguard. Also, you will know Vicky Jusen's known from The Witcher Blood Origin. You know that little Netflix action series which had Michelle Yeoh in it too, I think, and Minnie Driver and Lenny Henry and so on, and Dylan Moran too in a strange little appearance in that one. So she has put together this film with Kate Freund, who is an artist, writer and actress who has appeared in Creepshow, also wrote part episodes for Afterlife, and has had a lot of fun. But this is the spec'd script that Freund, that's Freund, wrote in 2009. Sort of inspired by the action movie Taken. But eventually got it up and running as a movie. So good on that spec script kind of thing is, it's a punt, you know. But if it gets picked up, well and good. So what is Pretty Lethal about? It's about a squabbling, competitive Los Angeles-based ballet troupe who are off to the continent to dance in a big deal ballet exhibition / contest, emphasis on the slash, in Budapest, Hungary. And they're forced to take shelter in an immediately sketchy inn or hotel isolated in the woods. What are the odds? Their bus breaks down. Little do they know that Uma Thurman, who has a deep, dark past connection to dance herself, is running the joint. Is it a dance macabre? Will they face the music and dance their swan song, or will they escape? Well, you know, they're probably not going to escape unscathed. In fact, they definitely don't. It is a little bit Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and, you know, it certainly does take a leaf from the... I thought actually that dance horror was a sort of a subgenre that that wasn't all of that well populated. But then I started thinking about it, you know, from the Red Shoes through to the two Suspiria movies to even the recent Abigail vampire movie. It's got a dance element in it. And so too has Black Swan, of course, based around that. There's actually more than I thought, about 20 or so at least, just to start, for starters. It does remind me a little bit of the Red Room in the Avengers series, you know, where a place that was picking out ballerinas to train into assassins. But these young women, they are not quite trained, but do they step up on point, as it were. This inn is a dodgy place with especially dodgy staff and dodgy clientele. There are Hungarian gangsters. So just think of a whole Eastern European disaster nightmare place to go. And the gag, basically the one joke gag of this, is that the ballerinas are actually pretty damn tough because of the enormously troublesome, difficult and physically taxing pursuit that they are engaged in. So who are the ballerinas? We've got Iris Apatow playing Zoe, basically the lead character, if not the leader of the troupe. We've seen her before in the Netflix film The Bubble. And yes, she is the a daughter of Judd Apatow and actress Leslie Mann. She's going to appear, that is to say Iris, in the Hunger Games Sunrise on the Reaping, playing Proserpina Trinket in that one. She has a good role in this one. She is a bit on the outer in the troupe at the start. You know, she's obviously not one of the richer people aspiring to the academy. But I think if memory serves me, she might be a bit of a scholarship student in this. But anyway, she's a bit downtrodden until she blossoms in battle. We have Lana Condor playing Princess, who is, her character is pretty much like what it says. We've seen her before, actually, Lana, in X-Men Apocalypse, where she played Jubilee. And she was also in the film Alita Battle Angel, as well as voicing the character in Ruby Gilman, Teenage Kraken. So a lot of these people actually have dance backgrounds as well, which is a good thing because you need them to do that in this. We've also got Millicent Simmons. And we've seen her a lot before. She is playing a character called Chloe, but we know her from A Quiet Place and A Quiet Place Part 2. She is a deaf American actress who really, really made those roles live that she played in those two science fiction horror movies. She is excellent as the character of Chloe, playing it a little bit for laughs too at some stage because she doesn't really know what's going on at first because she doesn't hear some of the terrible things that happen up front and just sort of wanders off on her own little quest in this. Yeah, she is great in this one, as she has been in the Quiet Place movies. Actress called Avantika plays Grace. Yes, one of those people who've got a mononymous stage name. She has been in Telugu cinema, actually, transitioned to American cinema, has been in some of the Disney channels and was in that horror movie Tarot in 2024, along with the musical comedy Mean Girls too. Maddie Ziegler plays a character called Bones. We saw her actually in the Lifetime series Drop Dead Diva. So yeah, she's actually kind of a go-to ballet actress, a young actress. Was in the episode of Nickelodeon's Nicky, Ricky, Dicky and Dawn in the episode Ballet and the Beasts. Also, we've got in the villainous side, Michael Culkin, English theatre actor. I've seen him a lot in things like The Crown. Was opposite Johnny Depp in the Mordecai movie, and so on. Playing a pretty solid Eastern European dastard in this film. And, of course, we have Uma Thurman playing Devorah Casimir, the mistress of this dodgy establishment. She's obviously having a hell of a time in this, a lot of fun for her in this, chewing the scenery and being very dramatic and being a bit of an on counterpoint to the ballerinas in the story because of her dance connection, which will become apparent as she goes along. It is an exceptionally gory movie. It is very bloody in all sorts of ways. It is actually very well choreographed, I thought, from a dance perspective and a martial arts one, as they sort of blend them together. It, in fact, contains some of the most dance-based mayhem that I have seen since River slew the Reavers in the Serenity movie, which actually happens off-screen, so perhaps it's even more than that. Where else have I seen dance-based combat recently? They had a dance fight in Argyle, so it's not an unknown thing. As I said, about 20 or so movies can really call themselves dance horror movies or so on. I did enjoy it. It is a B-grader. You won't find it floating up there amongst the A-listers. But, you know, for what it is, it's actually very well made. It's a bit of a hoot in places. It just does become a little bit formulaic towards the end. It's called Pretty Lethal, and it is on Prime at the moment. So let's have a bit of a track from this. Ballet, Blades and Blood. And this is by Paul Leonard Morgan from the soundtrack of Pretty Lethal. That's about it for Zero G for today. Joe Brunatic is coming up next with Astral Glamour, and we'll give you a...
G'day, this is Rob Jan. Thanks for listening to the podcast of Triple R Zero G, a weekly radio show exploring science fiction, fantasy and historical. Zero G is broadcast live on Triple R from Melbourne, Australia every Monday. Hope you enjoy the podcast and feel free to get in touch with us via our Facebook page or the Triple R website.